It's good to see you again.
Yeah. Did you remember me at all?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, my hair.
Especially once I see your face.
Yeah, my hair is shorter this time, so I know you must meet. I mean, you meet like so many people these days, huh?
Yeah. Well, these days, not as many as before COVID.
Right.
It's a little harder these days because now more people are their Discord avatars names on emails or Twitter or something like that. So actually it's a little hard, but once a face is really helpful. So
it's funny. I guess it was Monday. I was watching, I got my second shot at the grocery store. I came back and I was halfway through your Justin Brierley video that you posted the other day. And I'm like, you know what? Let me just check the link. Cause I had checked it a bunch of times throughout the last like 2-3 years. And I click the link, and then all of a sudden there's these two spots, and my heart rate just jumped up. Like I got like a text from a pretty girl. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. And then I was actually going like, oh, am I ready to talk to Paul now? Even though I've been watching him since like 2017. And then I was like, all right, I gotta make the appointment. So it's funny. I mean, I've been watching you since you had like, I remember like, it's so weird to see how YouTube is like, yeah, check out this guy. It was like, I remember like 970 subscribers. And I was like, why am I getting this rookie? No.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is kind of funny how the algorithm, as much as we, you know, it filters out who we see and who we don't see. Like to me, it's funny when I see Benjamin Boyce and he's been struggling at like 66,000 subscribers. And I'm like, well, that's weird because this guy's been, you know, in it for so long and he should be, you know, past 100,000 by now. Yeah. And yet sometimes there's this ebb and flows of who gets seen. And then I remember watching, I think I saw a little bit of your video, but really I saw you because of you. And I told you this last time, you had done an interview. I was watching this young man who had a channel called The Virtuous Life. And his name is Mason Ratté.
Yep.
And I, that was the one time I was like, I'm really not smart. Like this kid was 18 and he just was like, you know, Hebrew stories, biblical stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is where the conversation really is. And then all of a sudden I started seeing you. And that was the first time I started seeing this community kind of cross-pollinate. And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. And that was like, I think 27. When did you talk to him? 2017?
I talked to him. He was real early. I just had made a few videos. He was one of the first people that contacted me and said, you know, I'd like to talk to you on my channel. First, okay. They know that my MO in this thing has tended to be say yes first. So
yeah.
Okay. And so then we had that conversation and it was interesting because I remember he was a little sheepish because at that point a group of people sort of had figured out that you could build a channel by doing Jordan Peterson clips. Yeah. And so a bunch of people, I mean, Adam in Southern California too, Friend had, you know, he had a huge clips channel. And so they were doing his Jordan Peterson clips. And at that point, now you can't really do it like you could before, but you could monetize your channel. And so and he was a little bashful. He said, yeah, I started out doing clips, but he really wanted to do a lot of what I'm doing, which is conversation and exploration. And but that was pretty early on.
And it was funny too, because I remember when I first saw you, I think you were doing videos outside at first, right?
Yeah, I was playing around a lot.
And I was like, I'm a video, my background's video production and stuff like that. And audio is everything, because if it sounds like crap, people are going to be turned off.
Yep.
And it was funny seeing your, now look at you, you got your whole background, you got your microphone, your headset. It's so funny to see people kind of evolve during this time. But I remember actually you had a rockin' goatee. You had a really good beard.
Yeah, I had a big goatee then.
And it's funny because like, I think as someone that's like, I was baptized Catholic and my family wasn't terribly religious, but like I've been in those definitely secular spaces and then religious spaces where I'm like, in the beginning, you're like, okay, this is uncomfortable. They're praying around me. Cause I used to do like documentary stuff. But then you kind of get past that, and then you realize, like, oh, this really is two different worlds. And then when you start to see people, like anything with beards and stuff, I realize, I'm like, oh, that's always kind of giving me a little bit of like, oh, this is a little odd, this is a little weird. And I wonder how much of that is really kind of a little bit of a wall to kind of separate either the two, or what made people kind of going, that guy's not our side or our team. Even just like Orthodox priests, it's such a dramatic difference that I think it's kind of like, no, thank you. And how much it is just to get over that hump, or a little bit of like, you know, I think that's what's so great about you is that you straddle both lines so perfectly, where it's also tough probably for you also, because you're kind of getting pulled apart from both ends, where you're either not this side or there's like gatekeeping involved. I mean, I'm not sure if you experienced that, but you probably don't care at this point.
Well, being a Protestant minister is a little different too. You know, I look at the Orthodox fathers who usually are wearing black and they've got a big beard. Right. And then I look at the Roman Catholics, they've got the black shirt and the clerical collar. They're usually fairly clean shaven.
Yes.
It was so funny because I wasn't thinking about appearance at all when I started this business. I still don't think a lot about it. Right. And at that point, I just don't like personal maintenance. My beard doesn't grow on the top of my head very well anymore, but the beard just keeps growing. The beard is good.
You grow a beard. And that's why the other day I saw you shave that. I was like, oh, now I'm kind of bummed. The beard's gone.
And what was funny is that everybody on the channel has an opinion about it.
Everyone, right? But it's so funny how those things, like, that's why I'm always catching myself of, why does that bother me? That little gut feeling, you know, even when they're still, and I've, you know, especially after this whole, all this culture war stuff, my biggest main concern is like making sure that doesn't, you know, pluck that string anymore, where you have to be like, you know, lift the table up and be annoyed. Because you kind of want to get to a point where you're like, okay, cool. Well, I'm going to do my own. You need to like just kind of separate it. And to me, it's always so funny when there's certain things that you're kind of, you think you're over it, and then you see someone and you're like, ah, ooh, that's right. It's still kind of, I don't know why my body is still telling me that's a little weird, a little over there. Which is a funny feeling, how your gut instinct is really, as I've gotten older, I realize how important that is, really, just to kind of get that feeling. It's a pretty much a yes or no. You're like, okay, it says no. It's a no for me.
And you know, a bunch of people are like, you know, when are you going to become Catholic? When are you going to become Orthodox? And it's like, I don't know if I could do the, I'm such a plain church guy. I'm such a plain guy in a lot of ways. If I walk into, you know, I think cathedrals are beautiful.
Right.
And yeah, do church in them. That'd be great. But wear vestments, run the liturgy. I don't have any problems with it, but it's just not me.
It's such a big jump to do that too.
Yeah.
And that's where, like, you know, I've been slowly kind of coming back. You know, I went to church for the first time right after the Notre Dame fire. It was like right during Easter. I'm like, okay, but this is a sign. It's now. And so I grew up in Long Island, and now I live in LA. And so I'm not too far away from like the local church. So I'm like, all right, let me. And Notre Dame, like when that going on fire was like, to me, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was kind of like a spiritual 9/11 for me. Because I grew up on Long Island. So 9/11, I was 14 when that happened, was a massive flashpoint in my framing of a lot of things. And even as I get older, I see a lot of these people, these young kids who, I think Trump becoming president was also their flashpoint in their narrative of especially, you know, revolting or stuff like that. 9/11 was, you know, that day, you know, my father worked in the city. We've got friends that my uncle's a cop. My friend's father was a firefighter. You just heard stories of who nearly made it out. You know, my town lost a few people. And also I knew it. And I was always a history buff. And I knew immediately. It's funny because I talk to my buddies and I'm like, oh, when I saw that, I was like, we're going to war immediately. Yeah. And he, and my one friend's like, you thought that originally? I'm like, yeah, of course I thought that. Like, I was like, oh, we're going to war. And here I am, I'm 14. I have an older brother who's 17 who had just started college. He was going to Pratt Institute and saw the second one fall. My dad saw the second plane go in and he was like, all right, I'm out. I'm going back home. And he pretty much got out before they shut everything down. But I knew immediately. And as a young kid who's 14, you know, when you want to talk about like this sort of hero's journey or this sort of like idea from boy to man, it's like, oh yeah, it's military. And I remember, I think people forget that, like, they were talking, are we going to have the draft back? You know, all of a sudden it was like, okay, this is interesting. And it's, people don't realize that, like, when you're 16, when you do your license, your name automatically goes into the Pentagon. And so they kind of made it quiet after Vietnam of like, okay, all the young men's names are in there. I remember my mom, every time we went to the mall or whatever, it was always Marines trying to get to, hey son, how you doing? And my mom's like, no. And what's funny is I knew what I always wanted to be, even at a young age. So I was never really like, I'm lost. Like, I need to kind of fight this war. To me, I kind of thought, okay, I'll use my video production, I'll use filmmaking and try to like document this and go from that angle. But what's amazing about the whole 2000s was the range of emotions in just such a short time. I mean, The attacks happen. There's this utter shock of how cinematic it was because it's the most, you know, captured event pre-social media, which would be amazing if there was Twitter at that time with the footage inside of a building.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Right? That's what I think. Because if you notice today, and this is what, you know, to kind of pluck on that McLuhan string, where the amount of point of views we're getting now is so decentralized. And I'm an editor. And so when I see clips, I can go, well, what's a minute after that clip? What's a minute before that clip? Because we're seeing something that's selected to us to either fit a narrative or whatever. And with 9/11, it was kind of like this, okay, all cameras trained in the media, you know, capital of the world. We're seeing this event unfold. And I remember thinking like, wow, this is really cinematic. The explosion, everything about it was just gripping. And then you start seeing all the stories and stuff like that. But my town was like grieving and who came back. And then there's that sort of patriotism. I'm like, I don't think I'll ever feel that feeling again. I don't think anyone will ever feel that feeling of like coming together. I mean, we had a candlelight vigil at my town hall. And I was seeing people because I had just started high school and I was like, oh, that kid's in my Spanish class. And that kid's, and we're actually, you're meeting other people on different terms.
Yep. Yep.
And then I remember like, okay, there was like bombing in Tora Bora, but then all of a sudden 2003, it's like March 21st, Iraq war. And when you're 14, 2 years is a long time.
Yeah.
As I gotten older, I'm like, 2 years is nothing. That is such a fast ramp up.
Yeah.
And by the time I graduated high school in 05, and I was in college, and like, you know, then it's 06, and 06 was a full-on complete civil war in Iraq. Yeah. And I went from being a part of this thing and like thinking we're on the good guys. And now this project is falling apart and it's like, we're going to spread freedom and then lose at the same time. And I think that's such a whirlwind looking back. I'm like, that's why I want to tell people, I'm like, things move fast. Like it's, that's why, like, I remember telling kids like, you got to watch the news more. You got to pay attention. Like this stuff. I was like, you know, just being a jerk to a lot of people. Cause you know, people were like watching like the OC and stuff like that. And then these girls would have boyfriends that would eventually go over. And now they're worried about it. I'm like, well, yeah. But then eventually it just kind of fades away and no one talks about it. And it's kind of funny how things don't really have an ending anymore. They just kind of fade away. And I think that I was just talking to someone recently about that. You know, there really is no, even like the pandemic, there's no declaration of it ending. It's probably just going to fade into something else. And I think that kind of, it kind of screws with people's narrative because you want that sort of, you know, that parade down in like Manhattan or ticker tape or something.
That's interesting. So I was sitting a couple nights ago, I was sitting in the living room with my wife and my daughter, and we were talking about, you know, You know, another big change has been in my lifetime. So I grew up in the New York area, New Jersey. You know, very close to New York. I was closer to New York. I was saying this to my wife.
You're probably closer to New York than I was in the.
Yeah, I was like 50 miles from New York City.
Yeah,
from
the George closer.
Washington Bridge.
Yep.
Or actually, I was 15 miles from Manhattan. Right. So I could see the World Trade Centers from my bedroom window in my house in Patterson.
Yeah.
I mean, we're very close. And I wasn't living there though when 9/11 happened. I was living here in Sacramento. But so when I grew up, you had movies, you had radio. Yeah, obviously had print media, newspapers, magazines, and then we had, you know, TV in the New York metropolitan area, which was one of the bigger markets. So we had more channels than if I'd visit relatives in Massachusetts or Michigan, they had less channels than me. You know, then when I was in college, video started to come on the scene and you could watch movies on your TV without commercial interruption. You didn't have to wait for the broadcasters to put on movies. And then of course, HBO, cable television, that came a little bit before that. I'd never had cable. And when I was in college, I never watched TV in college. There's way too many interesting things to do. And then of course, now we have streaming and my wife, now with streaming, we get these, you know, these serials that are streamed and they can go a long time. I mean, really the limit seems to be the storyteller's discipline to not jump the shark and just keep selling a hit to make money.
Yeah.
And we're all sort of accustomed to that. It's like, okay, the first season was good. The second season, you know, same with the sequels. And so, you know, I'm sitting there with my wife and my daughter and I have all of these streaming services now. And we're talking basically about narrative arcs. And my wife makes the comment, which is very interesting, to the comment you were just making about my wife says, but the thing about life is there is, at least until the funeral, there is no completion. There is no parade. There is no, because you have all of these, episodes that you're dealing with your life. And they don't end, unlike these packaged narratives that we've had, especially movies, because, you know, 1.5 to 3 hours, boom, there you go. Used to be television shows, you know, 18 minutes or 45 minutes, bang, there it is. Now with streaming, it's a little bit more, you've got sort of a bigger canvas, but, you know, unlike, let's say, something like Breaking Bad, which was really, you know, it was obviously that, you know, obvious that he had this thing mapped out and he knew where to land the plane.
Oh, he landed it. He landed it.
Yes, he did. It was amazing. Whereas most streaming services like, oh, we got on. So then you know, they pull out all the stops for the first season and then, oh, we got renewed. Grabbing. Now what are we going to do? And it's
But that the thing about that is it's like, I never watched Game of Thrones and everyone was like, I remember when that show first debuted on HBO and I was thinking like, why is this type of show on HBO? Cause I'm thinking like, you know, Sopranos and growing up when HBO really was kind of getting into that gear. And then to give it the power of that sort of medieval times type of era, people just got hooked, but there was so much content and all my friends just busted my chops. You gotta watch, this is the last season, you gotta watch it. And then I remember sitting there when the last episode and it just crashed. And I was like, do you know who's proud of themselves? This guy. Because I did not burn 67 hours of this show. And what's so funny about it, isn't it crazy how that last episode literally nukes the entire series? I mean, that was in the conversation for so long. And then it ends. And literally the next day, we're like, all right, let's go. You know, that they were on to something else. And I go, and now that I live in LA.
But the anger over that Critical Drinker, you know, on YouTube, people are still, they're still angry about this. So one of my sons watched it and he sort of, and this was just less than a year ago, he sort of binged it, got to the end, was furious. He said, I just wasted hours of my life on that. I mean, he felt betrayed.
And what's funny is if you hear people talk, like, you know, the actors were really upset because they're invested in their character. They're like, okay, I don't get a proper send off or, you know, this thing. It's not even like actor ego. These are people that they're not big stars compared to other people. These are like British actors or whatever. And they have these little side characters that they want to kind of have their arc finished. And they're actually, when you hear them talk, they're like as thespians. They're like, this is not right. This is not proper. And then you could hear my buddy was saying, it's like, they're just like collapsing everything. Like there's a certain tempo that people like, and this is the problem with like editing wise, like things get faster. There's a musicality that even when you're reading a book, sometimes, you know, when you first start reading a book, you're kind of like, okay. And then you sync up to it and you can almost just start just burning through it because you're kind of in it now. And I think, even for a show, you know, there's a certain tempo. And then at the last season, when they try to collapse everything, everyone's just like, they can feel this in their chest. Like, why is this happening quicker? Why are you giving me all this? Yeah, you're giving me action. But like, no, I don't want that. Like, it's too quick. It's interesting how people respond to that. And they can tell, like, no, you're pulling a fast one on us because you need to wrap it up. And that's something that most people don't realize. I think even today that we're actually, because we're collapsing time so much, or even watching, like if you watch the new Star Wars and you watch older Star Wars, you're like, these are two different.
Oh yes.
Oh my God. I mean, I rewatched it out of like, May the Force be with you. And that crap, like I watched Return of the Jedi casually. And then I put on Rise of the Skywalker, the new one. And I'm like, oh my God. And it's funny, man. It's like, it's just shot. All this stuff, all this fan service. And what's funny is that because they do all the fan service and they do like a checklist, everyone's like, okay, cool. We're done here. Thank you. Yeah. And there's no feeling. There's no feeling whatsoever.
So with my, I've got AT&T phone service and a big family plan. So nice. With that, I get HBO Max. And part of what I'm enjoying about HBO Max is a lot of the older movies from the, at least older now, 60s and 70s. Maybe it's nostalgia, but I'll watch some of these sometimes just because I remember that era. But you're exactly right about pacing. You know, I was watching a Steve McQueen movie the other day, and I'm just watching this movie thinking, this would never pass today. This would never be made today. And
it could pass. I think you have to force the audience to be like, no, this is our tempo. Getting made, you're 100%. Like, it would never get made today. Never get made today. But I do think that I think audiences would be surprised at how they get challenged and how if you just force them a little bit, they will adjust. But the problem is like, okay, get them in a theater now. Forget that. Yeah. So, yeah. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, no, why wouldn't it get made? I'm curious about that.
Well, I mean, I live in LA now and I'm not really too deep. I'm still trying to kind of get into the industry. I'm on the outskirts, but I've got friends that are kind of, you know, your ear is closer to it. You hear what's going on. And it's, well, now the pandemic's kind of thrown everything up in the air because now, you know, with HBO Max, they're seeing themselves as like a tech company now. Right. Because they're owned by AT&T and Warner Media. So I've done work when I was in New York. Like you realize like how many of these massive companies are all together. And now it's not really like this. If you're a studio head in Hollywood, those days are gone. Like the idea of like, okay, we're going to make this type of picture. We're going to do that type of picture. Or we need more violence. And we need more nudity. That's gone because now you got Silicon Valley types who just see, you know, algorithms and they go, okay. Like even when they cast actors. So my buddy's been trying to get, he's a cinematographer and he's been on this movie that would be his first studio film. And it's been back and forth. It just kind of fell apart. And he was doing location scouts because a big actress was attached to it. And they were trying to kind of get another role casted. And all they do is they go down the line of let's say 20 male actors. And they just see what their numbers are. And that's how they just give it out.
Wow.
And then, you know, and if you're an actor, you're like, okay, well, Let's say I'm Tom Hanks. It's like, well, and if you notice too, a lot of these big actors, they kind of have their own production companies too. Like, just so you see Leonardo DiCaprio's got AP and Way. And so he knows if Leonardo DiCaprio's attached to your movie, it's going to get made because it's him. He makes these things happen. And then you realize, like, there's only so many big actors. It is, there's the hierarchy, right? You can only have so many people. If Tom, like, even though like Leo is obviously Leo, there is Tom Cruise, who is obviously at this point, like, okay, yeah, this is the guy that literally wants to die in front of a film camera. Like, this guy is like, okay, I'm going to die on camera. That's my last stunt, and I'm out. It's like, okay, Tom, relax. Like, calm down, dude. But he realized, like, how much this guy, you know, I know people that worked on Top Gun, and they shot for, like, 230-something days. And I, one of the guys that worked on it, he goes, yeah, Warner Brothers had to cut me loose because eventually I worked for so long. They were like, I would go into almost like an employee, like whole other thing. And he was on the aircraft carrier and everything like that. And he goes, yeah, Tom has his own crew of like makeup people and he's intense, but he literally runs that. He runs everything. And in Hollywood is that it's pretty much doing the numbers and seeing what works. And now with like, with you know, the cinematic universe of Marvel and DC, it's like, yeah, why wouldn't you? Pretty predictable. Like, you're not really going to take a risk. And also, it's tough to kind of get movies that are like $25 million to be made because you get producers, you may get an actor attached, but then the amount of money that just gets evaporated. Because what happens is, like, if you start out a tiny budget, you can get an actor that's big time. But then what happens is that once that actor gets on there, it kind of, the studio will bump up that budget. Then that budget gets bumped up and goes into a second tier. So then once you go into that second tier, by union standards, that DP gets paid more money, that person gets paid more money. And so the budget grows even more. And then maybe they're going, okay, you know what? We can throw another $5 million. And then it grows even more. And it's like, oh yeah, this is the reason why, like, you look at like going to war, you're like, you want to know why things just kind of expand. That's it right there.
Yeah.
I mean, they do something, and Warner Brothers does something where for the third act or a climax, I heard that they were going to give them some money to shoot this climax, like maybe $1 million or whatever, just to shoot it. But, and they, if they liked it, then they would give them the $10 million to really do it. And that's how they roll. And even with these superhero movies, they will shoot and then they will budget like maybe a month and a half later, a whole complete, like, for reshoots and stuff like that, just so that everything, because if you think about it, look at Star Wars, they reshot that so much, the last one, just to make sure that, and it still was a mess. And I knew someone, like one of the bars near me, that it was a guy who works in like the 3D department, and he looked like his soul was taken. Because he worked close with these guys, like literally, like with JJ. And he just looked, and that's what sucks is that these people in the industry are burnt out. They're burnt out. And they just want to work on something original so bad, you have no idea.
And I can imagine it.
And well, it gets evaporated like that. And they're just, it's just like the morale is not good in LA. Yeah. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, but it's interesting. So the two things that we're sort of picking at here, one is this question of conclusions, of landing the plane, of ending well, and the other is decadence, and they're related because they're really the opposite. Not if you don't know how to, you know, finish, it gets decadent, because, and then, you know, the tail is wagging the dog, the metrics are running the art isn't driving the metrics, the, you know, it's very interesting relationship, because I mean, again, we're watching it and we all know it. I mean, you go into YouTube, you know, I watch a fair amount of, you know, film video criticism on YouTube and, you know, the complaining like there's no tomorrow about what, well, you know, okay. Yeah. And at least, you know, for Endgame. So they landed the narrative arc on Infinity Wars, and I think they did it reasonably well. And so, but then you have the question with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Okay, what now? What now? Because, and then that's where really you hit decadence, because we've got too many sunk costs into this franchise, into this fandom that we have to perpetuate it. And, you know, look, think about Harry Potter. I mean, it seems like, I mean, there've been a few little attempts to try to, you know, get a little bit more out of the cow.
The universe. Yeah.
But it is so, but again, you've got an industry that I would imagine is full of artists who of us knows, you know, who of us really, we are subject to these powers. And I don't just mean the financial powers. I mean, the muse and these are stories writing us in a lot of ways. Now, not us writing stories, but it's both. And so right. I could very much understand how morale is bad because AT&T says, well, you got to have this guy and you got to have this woman and we're going to give you this money. And so it's gotta, because also with streaming, you know, unlike the movie theater where maybe they'll do, you know, they'll look at box office and maybe they'll get some surveying for people. But now with streaming, they know when people don't like a scene, so they turn it off. They know what episode people stop. They know what episodes people watch over and over again. I mean, the real thing about streaming is the metrics, because they are watching us watch them.
Yeah.
And that's got to drive the industry, because again, it's a commercial enterprise.
And it's also like, I think for the longest time, they were able to kind of play in that space where it's like, yeah, we sold this many. It's funny how they go, oh, it's the best box office. They'll never talk about how many people were actually inside of the theater. They only talk about how much money it made, because theater attendance has always gone down. I mean, the peak of attendance was, I think, Gone with the Wind or something. It's like you had theaters stacked with people or actual ticket stubs sold. Like that, to me, that's the best metric. But if you know, it's like, you know, I remember in 2002, I had like a ticket stub of Signs, and they jumbled on Signs, and it was $8.25. And I was like, now it's like $17 or $20 something or whatever. Yeah, and I'm like, that's crazy. And part of me is like, okay, you want people back in the theaters, easy. Just have a showing of Jaws, put Die Hard back in there, put Alien, and you're going to get people back into the theater in no time. And don't charge $20, you know? And also, I think the biggest thing is that at the end of the day, we don't really have as many artists or directors. Like, we don't have the Francis Ford Coppolas who literally have skin in the game. Like, they're mortgaging their house to make Apocalypse Now, or they're making, Godfather, which is a Italian-American immigrant story that is so family-oriented. Like, I rewatched that movie, and I'm like, wow, there's so much family in this. And that's a tough thing to do, because as a writer, they always kind of tell you, combine characters, try to kind of get stuff out so you can kind of get your focus, because it's tough to kind of have that many speaking roles and stuff like that. But I think with Godfather, it has more that melodrama. It has like, oh, that's right, this is a family drama, because you got Fredo and Sonny and these dynamics. And that's why that movie just hits another level, because it is touching something that is hard to actually land. And it's Francis Ford Coppola. He knows this world. And it's him. Like, he was fighting it the whole time. And it's serving his own, it's serving him. It's not serving the market. And I think all these movies are obviously always serving the market, obviously. But at a certain point, I think people look at the Fast and Furious movies, and I'm like, I haven't watched a single one. I saw the first one in like when I was in like 2001, and that was it. And I'm like, how are we still making these movies? And they're not even like, what's such a bummer today is like, growing up in, you know, I was born in 87, growing up in that early 90s where like CG was just, computer graphics was just kind of really clicking. And like the movie that did it for me was Terminator 2. Now you're going, aren't you young to see that movie? And your answer is yes. But Blockbuster, which was like my haven, like my parents would like watch it. And if there was no nudity, okay, I could watch, after they watch it, I could watch it. And I remember watching that movie and going, this is insane. And I realized like a lot of the movies that I love, when I was a kid growing up, were sequels. I didn't know. I never saw the first one, just by chance of where I was born. Like the chronology of these movies, I had seen Terminator 2, and the one movie that really kind of got me really writing or copying was Die Hard with a Vengeance. And there's a scene in Die Hard with a Vengeance, which you should, especially today in New York and the whole with the racial conversation going on. There's a scene in that movie where they connect it back to it being a revenge story. Essentially, the bad guy is the brother from the, you know, in the first one. It's a quick flash of the a bad guy falling. I remember being a kid and going, whoa, where's that from? It immediately expands your imagination of what the story is in.
Huh.
And that's such a, like, to me as a kid, when you're not really understanding what the adults are saying, and you're kind of, you're participating in in your own thing. It's an amazing thing. But the practical effects, the CG in the beginning, early 90s, was still an illusion, was still magic. And it really was a movie. If you realize, if you look at movies in the 90s, there was like almost a enchantment with, oh, that's a movie. You know, that only happens in the movies. And I think with Nolan, if you notice with Nolan, when he made those Batman movies, even with Michael Mann made a movie called Heat. It was so stripped away from all of the massive, you know, John Rambo, Arnold Schwarzenegger sound effects. It was, he made sure his actors were trained, you know, wasn't really stunt doubles. You could start to see like, this is a reality. This is taking training and technique and really kind of like putting it in there. And then Nolan takes that and puts into Batman, where we're seeing, you know, it's international. He's going to like Hong Kong and stuff like that. And people at the time were like, well, this is great, because this is such a different thing from Michael Keaton. But now, as you get older, you're like, now I rewatch like Batman Returns. Like, now I kind of want to go back to Batman Returns. I want to go back to that idea of like, we're seeing a stage and we're having sets and there is practical effects and there is CG. It's like, I want to kind of have this frame in here and not feel like it's like, yeah, Batman's walking down the block. I don't want it to feel like it's real. Yeah. And I think people are starting, like, even when you see CG in movies, the camera's kind of floating around, like it's not, it doesn't sell the trick.
Yeah.
And I think there's like, there's so much of that in everything now. It's like, there's no illusion, there's no trick. It's just flash this stuff. And I think honestly, just as much as it's a disenchantment with the world, movies is going to be disenchantment with movies, where you're just watching it and people don't really care.
Yeah. Oh, well, and the proliferation, the amount of content available just blows my mind. And, you know, so I'm much more of a decider, and my wife is much less of one. And so when she has the remote, she scroll.
Yeah.
I got to leave the room. I can't watch that much scrolling. Bang, done, watch. And same thing when we go to restaurants, we'll sit down and, oh, what shall we eat? What shall I eat? And I say, look, guess what you're going to do tomorrow? You're going to eat. So just pick something now. And if you don't like it, pick something different tomorrow. It's just today. And so, but the amount of content being produced
was a lot.
And, you know, given, you know, you talked about in terms of sort of a Pareto distribution, what Peterson would talk about, you know, there are these top of the hierarchy people. Now the amount of stuff being produced is an opportunity for a lot of people to get their hands and try to do something, but it's sort of like, okay, everybody can make music now. Does it mean that,
well, that was
not everybody's listening to the same musician still?
That was the thing growing up, was that, oh, well, now all this technology, like I started editing when I was in high school, because, you know, I had a class that had like VHS tapes. And I remember seeing, it was the first time there was an upperclassman had made a video and had cool titles in it. And I was like, how did you do that? And he's like, oh, I put it on my computer. And I was like, what are you talking about? How could you? I was just like floored. He goes, yeah. This editing program costs like $200. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to mow a lot of lawns to do that. And everyone talked about the dream of, like, you know, with Sundance kind of becoming its thing of like, oh, come now cameras. And there was like the CCD chip was like this thing during like when tape cassettes were there, and now you're getting better colors and you're digitizing your video. But then it's like, no, everyone's got a pen now, and the writing is crap. Everything is derivative. It's not, it's actually what it's doing. It's sort of just allowing more in there and for us to sift through, like, all those barriers that, like, Francis Ford Coppola and all these other filmmakers, that was the weeding out process. Yeah. You have to be a little off to just be absolutely dedicated to this craft. and to give up yourself and to actually know, like, not just movies, but cinema, you know, theater and acting and philosophy, and to kind of combine all those things. And now you've got, it's so funny. It's like, there's like screenwriter Twitter, there's film Twitter, and it's like, read it. And I'm like, no, like, I see this stuff. I'm like, you're all saying the exact same thing. It's very high school. Like, no one wants to like ruffle any feathers. It's like 500 shows. Everyone's trying to get onto the big thing now is like people want to get on a TV show. I don't want to get on a TV show at all because I'm like, it's probably going to suck. And then I'm stuck. Like, you sign a contract and you can't like do anything. You can't write anything outside of that technically. And I'm like, it's crazy. Like, I always thought like, yeah, you could, people would say you could just use your cell phone to make a movie. Like, yeah, but don't, like, it probably is good advice, because it is funny how you would think technology has gotten cheaper, but yet the budgets have gone up. Like, no one's actually kind of making these movies that are amazing. But I also think because there's nothing really amazing to talk about. Like, that's what I kind of realized back in 2016, was that I was like, what's going on? Like,
You know, it's funny when you talk about, you know, filmmaker Twitter. I mean, there's pastor Twitter. And one of the things, so I left, you know, I came back to the United States to do ministry, started here in Sacramento in 97. And at that point, the seeker movement had already peaked, but in the Christian Reformed Church, we're always a little slow. So we were sort of getting on board at the tail end of the seeker movement. So we had junkets to Chicago for Bill Hybels, and Wake Forest, Southern California for Rick Warren. And, you know, so I was just coming back from the mission field, and I was just, you know, well, this is your job, you know, learn, you know, business management by objective applied to church, and have the big sound and get the people in, and Rick Warren, you go, I mean, all this stuff.
Right.
And what you just described is, you know, eventually it was just pastors. They just get together, and then all of the language is the same. They have all of this jargon. It's one big think space where not original thought would come out of it. And they're all, you know, they'll think outside the box, cutting edge.
Oh, yeah, it's like an HR lingo meeting or something. You're like, this conference, it's amazing how much of this conference room talk has infested everything.
Yes.
And I'm like, my buddy, he, you know, he works at an ad agency in Brooklyn. And it's like, yeah, I'll ping you. I'll get you back on that. And I'm like, no, stop. Like, there's so much of this sort of corporate speak that's kind of trickled down. And that's why what's so funny is, like, I like to be the jokester or the jester. And it's like, I'm a freelancer. And when I worked in New York City, whenever I would come in to this edit suite, people would be like, oh, is Ivan off in today? Yeah, I'm walking in. Because I knew that in a weird way, everyone has to kind of perform these sort of, you know, roles of like, okay, I can't really do this. But if I walk in, I'm a freelancer, and I kind of almost lean into it with them to kind of make it realize, like, how dumb is this? Are we serious right now? Like, or you're going to client meetings and they'll ask some of these questions and you're like, oh my God, like, really? Like, are you guys serious? Like, I mean, some of the biggest brands I've worked for, like Nike and NFL, you're like, you think, whoa, this is Nike. And you go on the phone and like, these people are dumb. They're so dumb. Like, it's crazy. It's so crazy. And I think that's what's so funny is the higher you go up, you're going like, oh no, there's no adults. There's no adults at all.
I thought the people way up in those offices were supposed to know something. You get in those offices like, they don't know anything.
They don't know anything. And you realize at a certain point, it's like, yeah, I mean, if you're up there, you are sequestered. You're not really kind of know that stuff. And people around you are not really, at the end of the day, it is kind of funny. We overthink it, but people just want to kind of get their paycheck and not really turn over the apple cart. And
yeah, they're you know, hierarchy's bind and blind. They are locked into a system.
Exactly.
And they know to deviate from this system, there's going to be huge penalties. They're going to lose everything that they've established. I mean, the sunk costs in terms of their life. So then they just, and that is decadence. That is just... Yeah. And so you maintain this, and it happens in church, and it just happens all over the place. And so there's just always this freedom of being at the bottom where, you know, you can, you know, you're going to stay on the bottom if you keep talking like that. But it's just, at least if you give it up, you say, okay, it's fine. It's fine. It's absolutely, I would much, you know, I said the other day, I don't know, I remember who I was talking to, but it could have been Rick here at church or something. And, you know, some crazy thing just happened, because some crazy thing always happens here. All right. Because, you know, it's homeless people, or it's, you know, it's normal people. And I just said to Rick, you know, could go to a big church with a lot of people and, you know, a big organ and all of that stuff, but that wouldn't be anywhere near as much fun as this. I mean, this is just
you guys have
way more fun.
Yeah. You have like a show. You could write your own sitcom with that.
Oh, you could.
Which is interesting. That this is what I like about, like, with entering into this space, is that, like I said, like years ago, when I was like 18, I kind of was like, okay, I'm an atheist now. I'm done. I kind of really lined up perfectly well with that whole, pretty much the whole new atheist, without it being cold new atheist. I think what I realize now is that the advancements of just technology, of that feeling that, like, oh, we're in the future. Like, we're doing it right now. This is great. And just this idea, like, okay, every year, like, once, you know, you look at the iPod, and just every year, it's like, oh, it's got color now. You're like, oh my God, it's got color. This is insane. And then you have like a PowerBook, and you're like, this thing is metal, and it just boots up fast, and it weighs like 2 pounds. You're like, hell yeah, everything is getting better. And then you have the iPhone, and you're like, this, I mean, come on. It's just, it felt like things were just getting better. And there was writers I was reading, like Kurzweil, and that was this idea of the transcendental, like, human, and like, we're gonna merge with our technology. And then there was like Michio Kaku. Like, I went to a lot of my friends, like, we went to with like Neil deGrasse Tyson, had like a debate about, you know, string theory at the Museum of Natural History. And that was like the before he really became like Neil deGrasse Tyson, not to pat myself on the back, but it was like, okay, all these like
heroes. Everyone was before they became what they became.
Yeah. And it was just like, okay, we're seeing these people, and the amount of like these, I sat there and I was like, this is cool, but I didn't understand one thing. And I think people kind of were gripped by that idea of like string theory and like the Hadron Collider, and we're gonna do this. And it just, I feel like, I think for people that were excited for this change, we were riding with that car. And then the Hadron Collider does its thing. At first it breaks, and then they fix it, and then they smash particles. And they go, we found the Higgs boson. We found it. Everyone's like, cool. Let's go to Applebee's right now. And it's like, and you realize, like, oh, okay. So what the hell? Like, okay, can we, I just, that was it? Like, or we and that's, I think that's just so crazy. You want these, like, I don't know what we wanted, but it kind of happened. Everyone's like, all right, cool. You know, and there's, well,
that comes back down to, I think, you know, where we started here, which is,
right, with the no,
we want the consummation.
Yeah.
You know, and that's such an, in Christian theology, that's such an interesting term for that word. It's the consummation. It's the same word we use when they consummated the marriage, because you have the ceremony, you have the vows, you have the dress, you have the wedding. And then, at least in the old days, you don't consummate the wedding until after the ceremony. Right. But there's a, you know, and I think that's exactly the tension here between consummation and decadence, because decadence, you can't consummate. For some reason, there is something that is happening that is preventing consummation. But the consummation is what gives structure and power to the entire narrative arc.
Yeah, and it's that, and it's also, this is the power of the Christian story, is that it's the ability to play. It's the ability to perform, it's the ability to actually be inside of a story. And that's what the big thing for me was, that I wrote to you in the, I guess, little email thing, that I had wrote my first screenplay when I was 21. I was like, okay, I started writing when I was like in elementary school, and it's all imitation. I was just making versions of Die Hard constantly. Like, what if he was like, and yeah, it's this, or like, there was like a Dante's Peak could come out, and I was like, what have they not done yet? Okay, mudslides. We haven't done mudslides yet. Let's do some mudslides. It was just trying to kind of, you know, make your own versions. And I had no problem. I mean, even like Mortal Kombat with me and my buddy would always like, we would like make draw characters and all that stuff. And of course, they had the special edition of Star Wars came out like perfectly when I was in fourth grade and like just opened up the multiplex and it was insane. And what was I saying? So like screenwriting, like I realized like trying to kind of figure out like, okay, well, how do you write a screenplay? And there's these books. And this is what kind of, when Jonathan was talking about using the symbolism, it's actually kind of destroy you. I'm like, aha. Because at first I was like, no, whoa, I've been doing that like recently. Don't say that. Because I'm like, this has been working for me. But I realized what he really was saying. I like when he's talking about like what Jonathan opened up, the dot and the periphery and the hierarchy, like that, those mental models open up a whole, it just was like, oh, that those are my instincts. And I just didn't realize it. Screenwriting is tough where there's so many rules. There's so many, well, there's a simple, all right, beginning, middle, and end. There's an inciting incident that starts your story off, right? So let's say if our story, this whole thing that we're in is pretty much JBP, right? It's Jordan Peterson. That's the inciting incident when Bill C-16 came out, boom. And then there's these acts, the end of act one, and there's our midpoint in the story is when usually, you know, let's say you have this amulet or you're going to lose something, or like in Lord of the Rings, the midpoint of the Lord of the Rings, the first one is when they finally, the fellowship is formed and then they kind of go off. But the whole first half of that movie is them just getting out of the Shire and stuff like that. The thing is that you read these books and you realize there's a lot of books saying the exact same thing in their own words. And I'll bump into people who are other screenwriters and I'm like, oh, is this the thing with that? Did you do this thing and that? They have that word. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm like, oh, you gotta read that book. I'm like, oh, no, I don't. But you realize that they're all saying stuff, just different words that they don't have the same exact density as they're not strong enough. And after a while, like I wrote my first screenplay. I'm like, okay, get it. Let's do it. But I had like 5 or 6 false attempts of just starting and stopping. I couldn't break this thing. And I was so stuck in my head of like applying something, another structure into what I couldn't fit into. I couldn't really feel it out. And then when this, I started hearing Jonathan speak and then Jordan speak, it kind of destroyed that where I was like, okay, yes, that is the real way of actually approaching things, a deeper layer to the essence of something. Like it's a deeper well to kind of pull from. And I think when Jonathan talks about symbolism, that you can't just use it, it's exactly like a screenwriter book. It's like, you know, you can't, what's that saying with Jung, attaining, that sort of like that knowledge that's sort of like too quick. It's like, yeah, it's not going to work. You need Under to kind of knowledge. Go, you need to dig deeper and have a deeper well to pull from. And all those Christian stories were like, I realized I in 2016, I was like, you know what? I got to go back to the beginning. I got to start reading. Like I read A Hero of 1,000 Faces. And it was weird because I was reading that book when Jordan popped up and I was like, this is weird. Like the timing was like eerily perfect. And then all of a sudden I'm hearing Jonathan Peugeot talking about, you know, he had this lecture about the sort of, monsters in the periphery. And I was like cleaning out my closet and I was like, whoa, there was like a story I was writing that was very, very kind of like, yeah, that's exactly, he just articulated everything I was thinking. And you realize that so much of today is like that. We're all like working off of these screenwriting books that are just these quick things that you kind of do. And everyone's kind of talking about their screenplays. They're all kind of crap because they only took, you know, they only like read a book and they started doing it. And then you read like professional screenwriters from back in the day who are just starting. And like William Goldman wrote a book and he's like, yeah, he was an author. And then he read some screenplay. And then he wrote Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid. And you're like, how do you do that? Yeah. He read one thing and then he writes Butch Cassidy.
Yeah.
Like that level up is massive compared to today. Like no kid who's in college today is going to write Butch Cassidy. Because in a weird way, they're all drinking the same Kool-Aid in a sense. Yeah. It's like, it's all derivative. It's all crap. And I think that's everything we're doing right now. We're all kind of just, the words we're using are Instagram-y words. They're not... You know, you and one of your videos the other day, you talked about archetypes, and archetypos.
I kept hearing archetype. It's like, when do I use this word? Finally, it dawned on me. Oh, you idiot. You know, arche, I know what arche is, Greek,
right?
And tupos is type. Arche tupos. And arche, arche is a very interesting Greek word because it's first, it's highest, it's, you know, it's, you know, monarche, you know, monarchy
yeah.
is
yeah.
arche of one. Arche tupos is this, so in you've got this tupos, which is like this type, which is sort of like a reflection, and arche it's a fascinating
and doesn't it mean it means pattern though, right? Doesn't it mean pattern?
Yeah, it's something pattern like that? But it's sort of a colonizing pattern,
right? But isn't that's what's interesting is you went back and that word expanded.
Yeah,
and now all the words we use, they keep going forward, and even like, you know, we're psychologizing the crap out of ourselves, and now we have these Instagram words that are like that. They're over rationalizing of how people like, yeah, my life is miserable, but don't worry about it. Like, just do this, just be this positive. I'm like, oh, that's exactly what's happening. We keep pushing forward. We're rationalizing our doom into like different words that sound good. If we just go back one click and go, oh, what does this word mean? It just opens up everything to you.
Yeah.
And what you did about archetype is exactly what I did like five years ago, going, wait a minute, I got to start seeing this with fresh eyes, because I was a smug idiot. And I realized, oh, these things are, there's a reason why these things are real. Just this idea of like looking at it, like that's an amazing accomplishment to see what happened with the Bible and all these people. And to throw that away is so silly.
I only have a few more minutes left, but so what are your goals? What do you want to do?
I mean, the biggest goal is to be, you know, writer, director, editor. Right now editing pays the bills. I'm back in sort of that grind of writing screenplays, but you know, each screenplay is like another lift where you're like, you're sketching, you're overthinking it. You know, you have to be in a better habit of writing every day to kind of finish it.
Yeah.
It's tough. Like being out in LA, it's like, okay, you get closer to the scene, and it's very, very tough because I do feel like I stick out of sorts. I'm like, this isn't really my crowd, especially now. Maybe 2017 Ryan or 2016 Ryan could have had a better way of like flowing through stuff. But man, I kind of feel like, man, now that I know, now I'm part of the PVK gang, it's going to be a tough thing to kind of be like, I tell my friends, I'm like, Christ is coming back, y'all. And they're like, what are you talking? I bust their chops, and I'm able to kind of be back and forth with it, because I'm like, if there's another cinematic universe, it's going to be Christianity. Like, there's no, like, you're going to mine everything. You're going to go back down, because if I did it, you're going to eventually do it. And it would be, you know, it's funny. All my new stories now are all really based around forgiveness, I found out. There's a lot of forgiveness themes and like dealing with the kind of like revenge and stuff like that in some aspect, and self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because there is such a difference between pre-PVK, Jonathan Pageau and JBP, and now this. It's just, it's more focused. You're mining the wealth. To me, it's incredible how every path they go down is just like, man, open to so much to go through.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's so tough because I feel like I didn't have that much of an education, and I feel like I got this great curiosity. I'm like taking this, taking that, but then I hear some of you guys talk, and I'm like, oh my God, I don't know anything. Like I don't have any foundation of like the Bible stories and anything like that. And so a lot of it's me playing catch up and also mining, but also trying not to ruin that mining. Like I want to make sure like I'm not just like picking just to kind of pick something, but actually like, wait, is this what this term really means? Cause I want to make sure that this is right. And that's tough to kind of actually explore this, but also explore my story in my head. Yeah. There's two different things. But ultimately it's honestly what I would, all the ideas that you've been talking about and Jordan Peterson, Pageau, to kind of put those in narratives. I'm getting close to it. That to me would be the perfect thing, because that to me would be the actual thing that's supposed to happen, right?
Yeah,
all these ideas, and then they get nested in a narrative, and then I go, here, people, look, consume.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I hope it happens. I hope it happens. It's a crazy world.
It is crazy.
It is
insane.
It is. It is insane. I was, you know, Peterson did that conversation with Randall Wallace, and
I loved it. I watched it.
At first, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to want to listen to this. He's putting a lot of stuff. I'm going to listen to this. And I start getting emails from people. Oh, you got to listen to it. And then I listened to it. And then I fell asleep, you know, listening to it one day and didn't turn it off. But then after I got so many emails, I said, okay, I really have to listen to it. It was an amazing conversation. And I again, truth is stranger than fiction. This guy's life, you know, and we obviously through a conversation like that with Peterson, you get an edited version. We all edit our lives in a certain way.
Yeah.
We're all editors, but it's, I don't know. I look at my life and I never would have, you know, when I think about how I imagined my life would go, and I was never a person who really thought much about their future. That was always more take one thing after the next. But when I look back on it now, it's the best stories. It's the best stories.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about the people around me here at this crazy little corner in this crazy little church. It's just the best stories. And I have less patience with people who are editing their stories for Instagram. And much more interest with people who,
authenticity. Yeah,
that's right. Who doesn't know how to use a cell phone.
But also, like, I think the two things I was thinking about the other day was, like, whenever I have an idea or a lot of stuff I'm reading now, I read all these books and stuff, and most of it I'm like, okay, I'm reading just to kind of get through it, but also to really be surprised by something.
Yeah.
And then also be humbled by something too. You're like, oh, whoa, I totally was wrong off of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I think of what it is being surprised by someone and hopefully being humbled by them later on.
Well, I hope, I'm sure I'll, you know, now that COVID seems to be waning and more of us are vaccinated, I hope to get back down to Southern California and
definitely
have Ben Donk do another meetup.
I know. Is he still doing his meetups and stuff like that or online?
He was doing them online for a little while. He's always got another scheme. He's always working another angle. He's always got some crazy idea.
And see what's up. But yeah.
So anyway.
Awesome.
It was great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you.
You want me to send this? I made a copy of this. So I don't know if you want me to send it to you or.
Yeah, send it. Yeah. You have my email, right?
Yep.
Cool.
I got it. Take care.
Take care. Bye.